Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. I am pleased to welcome our guest today, Dr. Colin Klein, Australian Research Council Future Fellow and a senior lecturer in the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University in Sydney. Colin is also an associate investigator at the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence in Cognition and its Disorders, and a member of the University Centre for Agency Values and Ethics, both also hosted at Macquarie. Colin's research focuses on philosophy of mind and philosophy of science, especially where they intersect in philosophy of psychology. His current research projects include developing a manipulationist account of neuroimaging, defending an imperativist theory of pain, and defending various theses about reduction and representation in philosophy of psychology. Some of Colin's research interests address the following questions. Can functional neuroimaging help adjudicate between cognitive theories? How should information about the brain affect how we think about the mind? What is pain? And are insects conscious? Do they have subjective experience? And so, without further ado, let's bring in Colin. Let's take a step back, and I asked Colin, where did you grow up?
So I grew up in a very small town in Western Maryland called Walkersville, which is just outside of Frederick. I'd say very few people know of Walkersville, but I know of at least two other professional philosophers who've come there. So it was a town of about 2,000 people in farmland that was slowly being turned into housing developments.
Wow, wow. Which other philosophers were you referring to?
There's Brock Ruff, who I think is now a PhD student at Maryland, and okay. Thomas Harder, who's a bioethicist, who was actually my class here. I should know this better. He's somewhere down in the south, but
okay.
So okay. Maybe there was something in the water.
Walkersville, Maryland. So you said it was okay. So what was that like growing up there?
Well, there was a lot of time to think, I suppose. it was a relatively rural area. The school itself was a mix of kind of, I guess, middle class families that had moved from Frederick and still farm families. So, you know, the way I describe it to people sometimes is in high school, every year they had the Future Farmers of America pig slaughter where you could bring in your pig and make sausage down in the shop.
Wow. Did you grow up on a farm?
No. Okay. Although my father's side of the family ran a landscaping business, so I did work there in the summers. Sort of like a farm. There was a lot of hay, I guess.
Did you guys do landscaping on what kinds of housing?
Mostly residential, so mostly for housing developments. There was an army base in town, and every year, as a joke, that's what probably put me through college, was every year at the end of their financial year, they would spend up budget, and so the company would go and plant trees around there.
Sure.
Yeah. But, there was a lot of nice things about it. It was up sort of towards the Appalachians, so the next town over was kind of where Camp David was. People have heard of that. So there's a lot of nice mountainous areas.
Yeah.
I found that as I grow up, if I'm, you know, one of the nice things about Sydney is there's actually quite a lot of good hiking around it. When I was in Chicago, I loved that as a city, but I realized I kind of missed mountains around and that sort of thing. So
you're getting some of that back now.
Yeah, getting some of it back now, which is good and good for thought. You know, I associate walking around and either talking to people or just thinking very much with doing philosophy. So.
So were there any of these big thoughts happening at 7 or 8? Like what was going on at that time?
I mean, I guess I was always very curious. I always liked science. I was always kind of a precocious kid who thought a lot about things. There used to be this tape of me at like 4 or 5 making terrible, terrible science plans. The only one I know is the one I remember that I'm still quite proud of was that ants don't get sick because they have little antibodies.
Did you come up with that? That's great.
I must have. I mean, that's a quality kid joke.
That's some pretty high level wordplay there. I think that's pretty good.
And I remember having I think they're kind of standard philosophical thoughts. I remember having like inverted spectrum worries when I was, this is now getting more into high school, but thinking about inverted spectrum. Yeah, I read a lot. I read a lot of sci-fi. I read a lot of kind of pop science. So
what can you refer to, remind me what, the inverted spectrum theories? What?
Oh, sure. Sorry. So this is the idea that, so for example, when I look at this apple on my desk, I see it as having a greenish color. And you might see it as having the color that I see when I look at something red, but because we've grown up in the same world and used the same language, we both call that green. So it may be that I think this is funny actually. I wonder if people have this less now that there aren't photo negatives. But if you've ever seen a photo negative where the color is completely inverted, the idea that your world or your conscious world might look like that, but of course we use the same words for things, so it would be impossible to tell from behavior. And that's a that's something that real philosophers get paid to write about even now.
So. Certain philosophers of mind or philosophers of perception have struggled with that. Yeah, and I've heard variations of that kind of thing before.
Yeah, cool. Well, I also remember, and I've taught this a lot. I remember the other day of being on a bus to a football game and thinking about this problem that, so the image on the back of your retina is an inversion of what's in front of you. So things are up, in some sense, upside down on the back of your retina. And there's a thinking about this, and it turns out there's a long history of people asking this question of where does it flip back around? So if it's upside down on the back of your eye, where does it flip back around? But if you kind of start playing through that and you start thinking through it, there's a sense in which I think, look, it doesn't need to flip around at all, actually. I mean, this is kind of one of these deep things about representation. No more than, pictures need to be right side up on your hard drive to show right side up on your screen. So it's this question, starting to get into these things about representation. And
but if we have this little homunculus, of course. No, I'm kidding.
but that's the thing. It's this kind of homuncular thinking because it's got to get flipped around to show on the screen for the homunculus.
That's right. No, okay. Very nice. Very nice. What were your folks up to at the time?
Oh, what am I? Well, so my father ran the nursery with my uncle up until I was in high school, and then he got, I think, pretty tired of the business end. So he ended up going back to school.
A nursery?
Yeah, so a tree nursery. So it was the tree land nurseries. They did landscaping, but they also had a large tree nursery.
So they were giving and then helping to plant trees in and around in and around the area.
Yeah. Cool. So, and so now he's actually a professor of landscape architecture at Texas Tech University. So that was a nice career change.
Wow.
My mom was an accountant for various government, or sort of state-level government things. Mm-hmm. She just retired a few years ago. So,
very nice. Yeah. Was there, encouragement in terms of professional advancement? What did they, what kinds of advice did you get, I suppose, growing up?
Well, I think both of my parents wanted me to have a job that I enjoyed. I think my mom didn't dislike her job, but it was, it's hard to be enthusiastic about being an accountant in most cases.
Sure, sure.
My dad, as I said, was kind of unhappy with his job and so changed careers. And I think that actually did have an influence on me. And so this thought that, you should do something where you like getting up in the morning and going to it. I think my dad was always very encouraging. My mom, I think, was pretty suspicious about the philosophy thing, really, until I had a job. fair enough. I mean, this is not an unusual thing for one's parents to be a little concerned with.
Yeah.
But the idea that, academic job, I think both of my parents were very big on education. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that one would become a professor, that was definitely a good, that was a career, that was fine. As long as it wasn't the kind of philosopher where you were, smoking pot out by the grocery store or something.
Right, we know too many of those professors around.
Exactly.
I can understand. So did some of these science and or philosophical interests start to ruminate around middle school, high school years?
Yeah, I suspect around middle school, high school. I also spent a lot of time on the early internet. For better or worse. So of reading. So I remember internet before World Wide Web.
Please tell me about this. What was it?
So a lot of like kind of dial-up BBSs were a big thing. There was also an early thing called Gopher, which was really, all of this was non-graphical. It was really, so I got on the kind of, you know.
I think I remember Gopher or.
Yeah, Gopher. I think it might still exist. Mm-hmm. So I did the kind of like angry young man internet debates. I was actually, when I was like 13 on BBSs, and there was some of that. I mean, I think there's a certain kind of mindset. And I'm happy to have grown out of it in some ways, but that really uh-huh. attracts you to philosophy, which is this, like, you really want to argue about everything, and it's just, like, kind of argument for itself own sake is fun.
Sure.
It's
kind of competitive. It's almost like sports.
Yeah. And this is, you know, the internet, or pre-internet did play a role in that. So, you know, arguing with people online about whether God exists or about communism or, you know, all these, like, kind of very low-level things. But there definitely was an aspect of that. I was always kind of interested in technology in general. So, like, I remember one of the things that I was really taken with was, I don't know if you're familiar with Conway's Game of Life.
Yep.
So this is an old cellular autonomous thing. It's still important.
Oh, yeah, they're doing some, we have some folks here at Indiana that do some Game of Life studies. That's what I'm thinking I'm referring to with these, like, cellular, well, this is in the... In a form that has been enacted such to run simulations and such.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are more variety, like Game of Life turns out to be one of like a large space of cellular automata that you could have, and kind of studying which ones have interesting properties is really cool.
Yep.
But so I remember reading about this and like I taught myself to program and like programming like really, you know, really slow simulations of this on my ancient computer and then watching it go through. And there was always that kind of slightly technological geekery end to things as well.
So were you into, so it sounds like, did you do programming or study like kind of computer science like things or?
Yeah, but that was all self-taught. I mean, I think mm-hmm. I did take class in high school about it, but I already knew everything they were doing, so that was mostly me. It's an excuse to goof off and do stuff I wanted to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of these things that I, in retrospect, and I still do, I actually have been doing a lot more programming recently. I always wish I had learned some stuff more formally, but
sure.
It's one of these things that I just find satisfying, and so...
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm excited to hear more about what kinds of programming you've been up to, actually, in addition to the philosophy of cognitive neuroscience. So then after middle school, high school, where were you off to in terms of, did you go directly into university?
Yeah, so I went directly to college. I went to Franklin and Marshall College, which is a really lovely small liberal arts college in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. About 2 hours up the road.
Nice. Yeah. What was compelling you to go to this particular school?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I had kind of gotten in my head, and you know, it's interesting in respect because I'm not sure why, but I kind of gotten in my head that I wanted to study philosophy. I was also interested in kind of minds and brains generally. So I had a really nice campus visit and talked to some of the philosophers there, but they were also just starting up this program called Scientific and Philosophical Studies of Mind, so SPM. Mm. That was, and I think for its time, because this is now, to date myself, that would have been, I started there in 97. It was still pretty early in terms of interdisciplinary programs, especially at small schools. So that was a major that combined philosophy and psychology and a little bit of neuroscience they had. And I ended up double majoring in that and philosophy. So that seemed like a really attractive combination. And, you know, I lucked out, actually, one... can't really judge these things beforehand, I think, but the philosophy department there was very good. The small liberal arts experience was very good for me because if you're interested, you get a lot of kind of one-on-one contact working with people. I ended up having a fantastic time.
Sounds great. It looks like the program's still running.
It's still going strong.
Cool. And so you found your way into this, but how did that happen? Were you carrying over some of those initial interests from high school, from the internet debates, maybe in terms of things? Or, I guess those you said were about kind of a myriad of subjects, but You said you had questions related to things like inverted spectrum. Like, were these things that just you felt came naturally or came through your own experience of questioning related to the way the mind works? Or, you know, how did these interests in philosophy come to find your, how did you come to find yourself in this program?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's funny to think back to high school because it was, you know, part of it was fairly isolated. I just kind of read whatever I could get my hands on. So there was this amazing used bookstore called Wonder Book and Video. I believe it's still there in town. And this was before Amazon. So, you know, I used to keep lists of books I wanted to read and go see if they were there, because back in the day, it was very hard to find a book that you wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think I gravitated a lot towards partly philosophy. I should say I took a philosophy course. I almost forgot about this. I took a philosophy course when I was a junior in high school at the local community college. So we had this program where if you were ahead enough in high school studies, which I was, you could take courses at the community college. And the guy there was fantastic. I should really dig out what his name was and see if he's still around, because he was this is going to involve finding some really old computer files. But he was, you know, just a really enthusiastic, kind of low key, but like really engaged and really thoughtful guy. So I remember reading Kierkegaard and really liking it. We must have done some, philosophy of mind in there, did some metaphysics. So I was interested in minds and interested in kind of how people work generally, but that level of abstraction that philosophy was on, I think, always drew me in and thinking about, you know, these fairly big things. And I guess I had some facility with it as well. So, but, you know, I was also reading, gosh, I was thinking all the stuff I read way back, you know, I was reading a bunch of Freud. I was reading, you know, basically whatever I could get from the bookstore.
Yeah. Yeah. So how does, this SPM program, that you were in differ perhaps from what you might see today, which happens to be like cognitive science, I would say, for the most part. You might find some other science studies, but when you say scientific and philosophical studies of mind, it's hard to not see that as like somewhat of an, maybe a more philosophy focused cognitive science program, but similar too.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of it, and structurally, I think it, you know, philosophy-focused kind of cognitive science program is not a bad discussion, you know, not a bad description of it. I think back in the day, it was less neuro-oriented than you might find these days, partly because, you know, in the late 90s, like, fMRI hadn't really taken off, partly because it was a small college, you had very little, you had relatively, the facilities were more behavioral-oriented. There was one guy, Charles Heiser, I believe has left the field and gone into industry, but who did kind of synaptic chemistry and drug research, so mostly addictive drugs. And that's what I did the kind of senior project with on. So that was about as close as it got. The other thing that was unusual about it in particular when I was there is you get this thing where small liberal arts colleges, you often get people from more, I say, diverse philosophical backgrounds. So Bennett Helm, who was my advisor in philosophy, but was very involved in this, you know, he was trained in Pittsburgh. I got a kind of Pittsburgh Hoagland line through that. Tony Chimero was in SPM.
Really?
Was trained a philosopher. Yeah. So that was his first job. He came when I was a junior. And so he was my advisor on the SPM end. So kind of just fresh out of Indiana, in fact.
Yeah, and I've heard of him. I think we've met at, is he at Louisville? Or is it, it's one of those?
No, it's at Cincinnati now.
Cincinnati, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's a really, you know, still a really interesting guy. But that, through that, I mean, he had a kind of an activist Gibsonian dynamic systems line going, which you don't, I don't think is super well represented in large departments now. And even though there are lots of bits of that I don't buy anymore, but in some sense, like getting that kind of diversity of ideas was really exciting. I feel like sometimes I tell people about things like that, like I probably have fairly mainstream views about what I actually believe, but I'm willing to entertain a lot of things because, you know, I've seen smart people like really
more than some people are willing to do. So
yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think that was, and I'm trying to think what else, but so it was definitely more behavioral psychology oriented, although we did do a lot of neuro stuff in there.
Sounds like sounds like a great program.
Oh yeah, no, it was really exciting, and I think it prepared me really well because the philosophy end was quite good too. So
at this time, had you made the decision that I'm going to go to graduate school, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, I think from fairly early on, I thought that was what I was going to do. I mean, I think, I don't know how it is for people these days, but especially at a small liberal arts college, being a professor seemed like a really good life. You know, you were smart people, like doing the things that they did. You don't get a picture of the admin. You don't get a picture, you know, a lot of the bad things you don't see. But I think also, at least at that time, it was a nice life. You know, Lancaster was like us at that point. It's much better now. But it was kind of a sleepy town, but, you know, people had big houses and walked to work and talked about stuff they cared about and
had a good life.
It seemed fun. Yeah. And, you know, my professors encouraged me a lot to apply to places as well. Mm-hmm.
That's it. Must have been then a big shift because a small liberal arts, you know, is a very different experience than jumping to an R1. It's a tremendous. And I imagine as you did with, where did you do your graduate studies?
So I went from there to Princeton.
Okay. So excellent landing for a PhD student, one of the top programs.
And that was, I mean, I was lucky in part. One of the guys who I doubt many people have heard of these days, Michael Roth at at F&M, older guy, did ancient philosophy. Never published much, but he was quite well connected. And so he used to have these amazing conferences because he was friends with David Armstrong. And if Armstrong came, Lewis would come. And then if Lewis came, anyone else would come. And so and then Armstrong came and visited for a semester when he was working on the Truthmakers book and did a seminar on it. So I got a letter from Armstrong and I think, you know,
helped pave the way.
It was this kind of like, it was this thing that helped pave the way. So I think back like how grateful I am about that.
Very nice. Okay. So going into Princeton, what was this, what was it like going from a small liberal arts college to a slightly bigger school?
Oh, I mean, I think ego-wise, it was crushing.
Okay.
I'd gone from being the kind of, you know, golden boy to being a kind of among these amazingly intelligent people. It was a really hard adjustment. I had I tell people, I had a terrible first year in graduate school, also for some personal reasons.
Sure.
Long-term partner.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah. Sorry to hear that as it happened like years ago, but still, that's tough. It's never easy to, you know, in your 20s, just,
I mean, I'd kind of, the one thing that kept me above water was I was always quite good, much better than I'm these days at kind of technical stuff. So I was, there was a graduate logic course that I did quite well in. Mm-hmm. But I was falling behind. Princeton also had what I think was a really great training, but you wrote papers, it was called the unit system, not for classes, although they were often associated with classes, but essentially you had to write 10 papers before your generals exams. And they could be on anything, you had to work with the professor, and they weren't done until the professor was quite satisfied with it. So they weren't graded. You had to convince them that you had written a good paper. And a lot of those I ended up publishing later, I think, as a lot of people did. But that made it easy to get behind as well, which I did. So I think one of the things that bad year taught me, and so essentially that summer breakup finished, and I kind of sat down and had a long think, and I thought, well, I'm not the genius I thought I was. But... you know, and I still think that, but I think I was quite mediocre by Princeton standards. Like, there were just some amazing people there, and people have gone on, you know, I was in graduate school with people who've gone on to have amazing careers. But I thought, well, I can fall back on this kind of, work ethic that I got from my parents and, like, kind of sit down and figure out how to write steadily and, like, get through and do the things I have to do. And that's actually served me very well. So by the end of my second year, I was caught back up. I was actually a little bit ahead. Like, you know, I kind of I figured out how to work and figured out how to do. And that's a big thing. I think a lot of people get hung up in graduate school just on the writing or just trying to get things down. And I just, you know, learning to write steadily, I think, even if it's not great stuff and thinking, you know, you'll edit it later or you'll figure it out, you get a lot further that way than waiting for lightning to strike.
Well, I appreciate you being candid with, you know, your experiences in the first year, and especially going in, like, the experience of then, you know, maybe coming from a lesser, well, like, you know, from a liberal arts college to an Ivy League to something. And I know, you know, I've had some friends and folks who have had the situation or who might even be going into the situation fairly soon that, you know, are a little nervous about that. And I don't know, do you have any advice or like recommendations? I mean, just your share is fairly, you know, it's telling.
It's good. You know, people don't actually talk about that aspect as much. I guess the two things, both now as a professor and from thinking back then, the worst thing you can do is kind of disappear. So I think people get this thought that they have to, you know, they have to give their teachers good work. And then if they're behind, they have to give them even better work. And then all of a sudden it's 2 years before and mm-hmm. nobody's seen them. You get in this kind of
feel embarrassed that like you haven't shown, so you're like, oh, I really got to show them now, and then
So I think one of the nice things about Princeton was it was kind of hard to disappear because it was a small town and it was a boring town, and so I mean, I should say once I got over that initial hump, it was great because it was a very good graduate community and there was a lot of like sharing with people and talking through ideas and getting new ideas, and I you know really learned a lot from that. And I think as much as you can be part of the life of the department, talking to fellow graduate students, going to talks, talking to professors, like that really makes a difference. Because a lot of time, I think just sitting on your own and brooding, that's the thing that's terrible. And, you know, it depends. I mean, obviously different places. So I should say when I was at University of Illinois, Chicago, and now here in Sydney, it's tough when you're at a university that's in a big city with other interesting things to do. I mean, Princeton, there wasn't much else to do.
You could probably escape a little bit better in Chicago than you could.
Yeah. And in Sydney, you know, it's kind of an effort to get up to where Macquarie is, so it's easy to not make that effort. But insofar as you can do that. So, like, now I have a work in progress seminar that I run for my graduate students just to make sure everyone's coming in at least once a week and talking to each other and hearing what people are working on. And that's been good. I've had grad students now who are like collaborating with each other on things, like getting ideas. So that's been nice. But yeah, don't disappear. and I think in general, don't, you know, you're not this generally like, well, it's a good two advice. One, you're not the only one. I think many people's grad student experience is much more alienating than they talk about. And two, I guess the thing that served me well is this old saying that the best is the enemy of the good. So getting things finished is often much better than trying to make things perfect.
I think that's some good advice.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So as you started finding your way after that first year, you know, what kinds of work were you doing? And, you know, was this at the time when you started focusing on philosophy of cognitive neuroscience?
That was a transition while I was there. So originally did much more kind of metaphysics of mind sorts of things. So interested in the causal exclusion problem. I initially worked quite closely with Karen Bennett. So I had interests in scientific stuff. And one thing that was really nice, so I think Princeton now has a formal program for like a certificate in neuroscience or a dual degree. And that was just starting when I was there. I'm still not quite sure whether I couldn't do it or I just never found the paperwork, but I did take courses over in the neuroscience department as well. And two that were really influential over there. So I took one from Jim Haxby on fMRI methods that was really good and really thorough. And then one from Michael Graziano, which was just the first year pro seminar on neuroscience, but he was an amazing teacher. So he just really like, I learned a lot of neuroscience. I learned, you know, and learned it quite well, I think, just because he was so good at it. So I was starting to take those courses. I was talking to people who were around. Princeton always had a kind of a little bit of overlap, at least. And shifting, I think I, you know, over the course of my dissertation, I realized that the questions that interested me were increasingly philosophy of science questions rather than the, or I thought the philosophy of science questions were bearing more and more on the metaphysics of mind stuff. To the point where, yeah, I think between then and my first few years out, shifted over almost completely into thinking of myself more as a philosopher of science. So,
so maybe you could share with us, in terms of doing metaphysics of mind and then doing philosophy of science, what are how do the techniques and the tools compare? What is there any overlap in terms of approach, and how does maybe one inform the other?
Yeah, I mean, so it's an interesting question. And here you're going to get a kind of biased view because of, and I've published some stuff on this now as well.
Oh, cool.
So some of my earlier papers on this. So I think there's a way of doing them. And if you look at metaphysics of mind, particularly from the kind of late 70s, 80s version of it, so I'm thinking in particular of Fodor and the kind of Fodor-Kim debates.
Yep.
There, what you see, there is a picture of science there, and there is a picture of how science works, and there's a picture of what scientific theories are, and the important thing for me is there's a picture of kind of what ontological commitments you have given your theories. So, and that's very much inherited from the late positivists. So, I mean, I can talk about that a little bit more if you want, but essentially the idea that a theory is a set of sentences, and your ontological commitments are kind of what you quantify over and what the predicates are. Now, and there's also areas of philosophy of science which were quite general like that. But also, one of the things, and that was starting to become more and more a shift of for me, is I think philosophy of science in general has moved much more towards looking at particular scientific theories. So from the Hempel era, where you're talking quite generally about science and what scientific explanation is, to looking at particular subdisciplines and looking at how, you know, particular kinds of theory building work. And one of the things that happened in, as I went through my dissertation, is I realized that these kind of standard stories from metaphysics of mind of how scientific theories worked just bore no relation to what people were doing in philosophy of science, and tended to underestimate the complexity of science itself. So my dissertation was actually on idealizing explanations in science. So, you know, what you do when you say, look, you know, let's suppose that we have an infinite population of rabbits, or an infinitely brittle or a perfectly brittle solid. I was really obsessed with material science for a while. And part of the thing, and I think that in retrospect, the shift there was me starting to think about, well, look, once you move to what's sometimes called a more model-based picture of science, you realize that questions of ontological commitment become really tricky, because you can't just read an idealization as a start case of this. You can't just read what exists off of an idealized model, because in many cases they're deliberately falsifying parts of the world.
Yep.
So that kind of shift and moving down that line, and then thinking more and more about the particulars, so I thought, okay, well, you know, let's look more, and so in the dissertation what happens is, I said, well, let's look more at particular cognitive models. So I did some stuff on, like, different models of face recognition and how prosopagnosia comes up. And, like, and thinking more about, you know, well, do these models really conflict? What's going on? How idealized are they? And I think that's what pushed me down more and more to thinking about particularities in science. Some of it, I think, too, is just, you know, I have a paper on this now, but one of the things I realized as I was getting frustrated with all this is, you know, there are these old, this old Putnam line that about the, I don't know if you know the peg in the hole example. This is a very famous, so the idea is you could give an explanation of, you know, you've got a square peg in a round hole, or vice versa, and then one doesn't go through. And Putnam says, well, you could track all of the atoms, and that's what physics would do, or you could talk about the shapes and why the shapes don't work, and that's obviously the better explanation. I remember talking to my father-in-law, who was an amazing man. He was a physicist, and he worked on turbulent flow, and he said, basically, like, well, my whole life has been trying not to talk about atoms, because once you go down there, you're basically, it's too complicated. He's like, so, you know, this realization that even physicists did a lot of abstraction, you know, even physicists talked about shapes. So the idea that you were talking about shapes didn't automatically mean you had left physics. And in general, thinking about the, you know, the kind of, even within physics, these complexities. And so, you know, moving away from this, and I think there is, you know, I don't know what to say about what people do now, but like certainly then there was this picture that like physics tracked atoms and that was it. Yeah. And it's weird when you put it like that. I mean, it's a, I think it's a historically weird kind of way of thinking about physics that kind of comes back probably from the rise of particle physics.
Yeah. I'm sure we have some historians of physics here in India. I'll have to ask them. What is this way of generally, this general approach of just, we're just figuring out where the atoms are and how they like
yeah. But you, because you say, I mean, what little history I know, even in Quine, for example, and Kim has a nice paper on this later on. Even in Quine, physics was not the science that dealt with the smallest things. It was the science that had kind of unrestricted quantifier. There is the science that dealt with things most broadly. So gravity applies everywhere.
Sure.
There's a great line that I'm not sure I can do anymore, but from a review of his of Goodman, it says something like, you know, physics is great because, you know, it's the science that deals with everything, and biology deals with some bumps on the surface of the earth, and psychology deals with some bumps on those bumps. So
it's so, oh man. Okay.
So, anyway, so that's all so then between that and then also thinking about fMRI, which was becoming a kind of big and controversial topic. So it was a part of the kind of first wave of both super enthusiasm and attacks on it. And I'd taken this course, and so was thinking more and more about that as well.
Nice, nice. So what was the dissertation ultimately on?
So it was ultimately on idealizing explanations in science.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, and ontological commitment from that. So there were some metaphysics in mind, but it ended up like chapter 5 and 6 rather than chapter 1.
Okay. Great. Great. All right. So then, what came next was finding the job a fairly easy process. Was getting work. How did that come about?
I mean, it didn't seem like it at the time, but in retrospect, I went out in the, you know, the kind of late but still golden years of the job market. So in retrospect, I'm really grateful. So I went on the market in 2005, and this was, you know, in the days when the JFP would come out. I think I applied for 80 jobs when I went out. So there were 80 jobs for people in philosophy of mind, philosophy of science.
That's quite a few. I feel like.
Yeah.
I wonder what the year, it's certainly less than that. But I wonder how relative to that it is. Anyway.
And then, you know, had convention interviews at the Eastern APA. So you'd go and sit in people's suites and have conversations about this. And then there was the smoker, which was the big reception. And there were these numbered tables. I was just at the Eastern and there were like 5 of these left, but it used to be like 100 tables and you'd have a little guide to where different schools were sitting, and you'd go and try to make awkward chit chat in your new suit. And
sure.
although I ended up at that, and I think, you know, I met David Hilbert, who ended up becoming a close colleague and friend. So I had an interview with UIC and then ended up talking to him for a long time about color at the smoker. So I guess the schmoozing actually worked. Yeah, schmoozing must have helped. Although I think I was actually the last person at UIC who was hired through the system, and then we switched to just reading and flying people out. Because there's a lot of evidence that kind of empirical evidence that face-to-face interviews are a pretty poor way to, you know, short face-to-face
ultimately
way to like judge anything about anyone. So, I mean, I went through, I did that. I was lucky. That was the only, I had a fair number of convention interviews, and then UIC was the only one who flew me out, and I got that job, which I was, you know, happy and grateful about, and that, and they ended up being a wonderful department. So
yeah, so your time there, maybe you could share a little bit about, you know, what it was like in your first position, you know, how long you were there for, any particular projects that you really enjoyed working on, or anything else about the experience that was interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was an interesting place. It was in Chicago, which I had not, you know, never really spent time in before, and had, I think, a bad impression from the East Coast. I thought it was just gangs and snow. It turns out to be a really lovely city. I really enjoyed the time there. The department was nice. You know, it was one of these, I mean, you're closer than I am, so you know Illinois' woes in terms of budgets, but it was kind of perpetually underfunded state school at the big level, but the department had a lot of autonomy. Just a lot of really good, thoughtful people there. So I was very close with Dave Hilbert, who had the office next to me, and we chatted a lot. And I think I really learned a lot from him in terms of like approach to thinking about empirical things. And then, but the whole department was great. I feel like I also, you know, spent time talking with Maria Schechtman. They did have this laboratory for integrative neuroscience that I was a part of. And it was actually quite nice. The philosophy of mind class that I taught was part of the neuroscience. It was required for the neuroscience major. So I got a lot of those people coming through. Mostly they were pre-med. And that was good because they were good students. It was also, I should say, culturally a shift from Princeton, which is kind of as tony and privileged as you imagine. Which, you know, and I don't mean to denigrate that. Like, it was, that was an amazing place. But
so, yeah, what was that shift like?
So, I mean, UIC, there just, there wasn't a lot of money around. There were all kinds of state purchasing rules, so you know, you couldn't have wine at receptions and things. But also the students, I mean, in some ways I still miss it. The students there, by and large, college was really going to make a difference to them, like in a very practical sense. So they were, a lot of them were, I think when I was there, it was maybe 30% were still the first people in their family to go to college. It was going to make the, you know, it was going to make a fairly large jump from working in a dyeing factory on the south side versus being in, having an office job or something like that. Or, and so you got a lot of people with, I still tell you, I've got my bar for what sounds like a good excuse has now gotten so high because you just hear these people with like amazing life stories or, you know, I can't make it in because my mom has MS and like, or, you know, I might be deployed to Iraq or, you know, people who are like just really living like really terrible lot. Or not terrible, I was just like really hard
just lot. Lives with like these like stress events that you probably not, those that who are attending Princeton aren't necessarily experiencing.
Yeah, yeah. So that was, and I think it was some of it was adjustment because, you know, they didn't have the kind of, by and large, there wasn't this leisure. Like Princeton is very much, you know, there's a lot of time to sit and talk and like give projects. Whereas there, I think people had complicated lives outside. So it was a shift in the teaching, thinking about what you could expect and, you know, what students were going to do outside of class, but a good one. Like I enjoyed teaching there by and large. And yeah, so I was there from, I started in 2006 and I was technically there through 2013, although I actually moved to Australia at the beginning of 2013 and never came back. So,
so yeah, how did, okay. How did that shift then come about then moving to Australia?
I met my now wife at Princeton, so she's a sinologist. Yeah, that was all Center for Human Values money. There was a graduate student reading group called Interdiscipline and Punish. That was great, and they kicked in money for pizza and beer. And,
nice.
It was kind of free-flowing discussion. So I met her there, and yeah, essentially that it was one. It's been one long process of trying to sort out a two-body problem. So
yeah, so you're a successful graduate student situation. Yeah. Or yeah, was she so, a graduate student at the time? Or?
Yeah, so she was also a graduate student at the time. Okay. I guess what sounds... The other advice I give philosophy graduate students is go outside of your department if you're going to do an academic.
yeah.
Because I had a lot of luck with that.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Although marrying another academic turns out to be a more complicated situation.
Yeah.
So she actually... She applied for and got, I mean, the story is kind of complicated, but she ended up getting a job at University of Sydney, which was quite a good job. So they were building up the China Studies Center there. So I took leave. I took what was effectively a postdoc, although Dave Chalmers was quite generous with that. So at ANU, so I could be there while we tried to sort things out.
Oh, great.
And that was a fantastic year. Like ANU is just really a gem in terms of they've got a, if people aren't familiar with it, they have a kind of visitor season in the northern summer where people find a way down to Australia and there are, you know, just tons of people. There's tea and talks. And
oh, wow. I didn't realize. So do they welcome you for, you can come for like a semester or a year or something like that?
Or a lot of times people just come through for a couple weeks. So
oh, okay.
I think one thing that's, you know, basically one thing that happens is people realize they can come to ANU for a couple of weeks. It's really fun. And then maybe, you know, go see a bit of Australia or go to some other places. So just really, I'd visited when I was a graduate student for 6 weeks and really loved it. And so that year was just really intellectually stimulating. Like, I got a lot of stuff done, just a ton of people to talk to. And then in there, I'd applied for and got this job at Macquarie. So then we ended up in Sydney, which I don't think we would have bet on beforehand, but there you go.
So how has it been then doing philosophy of science, you know, as someone from the States, now moved to and now living and working in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, it was more of a cultural shift than I expected. Partly, and maybe coming from a U.S. city as well, I had lots of little things that take you a long time to get used to. And the academic system is actually quite different. It's much more, there isn't tenure, although there's job security, but it's much more kind of top-down and managerial. So, whereas in many, certainly UIC, we were essentially mostly like a little fief trying to ward off anything that, you know, administrators wanted us to do. Whereas this is a bit more like working in an office. But I mean, the Sydney area has been really great. So there's, well, at Macquarie, there's a very good cognitive science program. So that's been great for me. I've had a lot of collaborations over there. But also Sydney Uni, so you interview Dominic Murphy, and a lot of the people over there are great. And Australia generally, I think, there's really been more and more of a shift towards kind of empirically oriented philosophy of science, philosophy of mind stuff. So there are also good people down in Melbourne. So it's an exciting place to be and kind of exciting time to be. And Sydney is a great city. It's really, aside from being horrifically expensive, it's like living in the Bay Area, but it's gorgeous.
Really? Oh, jeez.
So you got that going for you, at least.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a wonderful opportunity. And so, despite, I didn't realize they don't have some sort of tenure system, but
no, it's much more like the UK system. So,
okay,
yeah, I'm very. It's inherited from the UK system, although, like everything in Australia, has kind of grown its own weird shape.
Great. So, as recently, maybe you could tell us a little bit about some projects you've been working on, or anything that's. Anything of recent that you've been excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a few things going on that I'm excited about. I've been working with a colleague here at Macquarie, Andrew Barron, who's an insect neuroscientist. And he and I, we met kind of by chance, but we ended up publishing a paper together in PNAS last year about arguing that insects have at least a form of subjective experience, based mostly on neuroanatomical considerations. And that was fun. I think that was better received, actually, than we even thought it was going to be. So through that, I'm talking with him more. We've been interested just in general writing, thinking about kind of evolution of the brain and kind of some of the principles that might be there. And so we've been working on that. I've got a project that grew up out of working with the delusions folks here that's spawned several projects. And that's the one I've been doing a lot of publishing or programming on about conspiracy theories and conspiracy forums on Reddit. So doing kind of text analysis and network analysis about how people get into conspiracy forums, the kind of different interests that are in there.
Interesting. Could you tell me a little bit more about that and what have you found or what are you thinking in terms of how can you explain? I feel like there's been work more in like even popular science in terms of trying to explain the result of conspiracy theorists or the draw toward believing in such ideas. Yeah, have you found?
So, I mean, one thing we found, and that some of us had kind of independently thought to begin with, but there's this real selection bias when people think about conspiracy theorists, because you think of the people who are like super gung-ho and write tomes and write into the newspaper and things. But one of the interesting things about social media is it really opens up kind of casual participation. And so you find, and there's this amazing data set that's basically every comment made on Reddit from 2007 to 2015 that you can, so you've got, you know, several hundred thousand authors with a few million comments in conspiracy. And what you find is actually really quite a lot of diversity. So there are people who write very long tomes and who really get into it, but there are people who seem to get into it mainly because they're worried about, for example, gun control, or they're worried about U.S. foreign policy. There's also, I think, a large group of – there's one fairly distinct group of racists where the conspiracy theories are kind of – I think this was big during the Obama years, but there's a lot of anti-Semitism. But so you get really what's, I think, quite a diverse group. And we're looking at now is another nice – my co-author just sent me a graph of this, which looks great, of different routes into conspiracy, the forum, essentially where people are posting before they end up there. And there are, you know, ones you would expect, like kind of traditional right-wing things. There's also a really strong libertarian path in. There's also a far left-wing route in through things like Occupy Wall Street and kind of the harder, environmentalist stuff. And there's also one that just looks like people who just like drama, like who like Reddit drama. And so it's this kind of interesting thing where you get in, and one of the things I've been thinking about more is this idea that it's really a kind of interesting unit of analysis is actually conspiracy narratives. And they have this kind of narrative structure that lets lots of different people with different interests appear to be engaging with the same thing. The other thing we've found, and I mean, I've been interested, getting more and more interested in this, is this idea that, you know, it's easy when you see someone who thinks, look, you know, world leaders have been replaced by reptilian aliens. Like, that just seems like a delusion. That's actually how we got interested in it originally, because there is a branch of conspiracy theories that's probably just clinical delusions. But a lot of people, I think, you get this more subtle process where it's really this, you start distrusting sources in the media. And you get down this one-way path where you'd like to know what's going on, but there are fewer and fewer people you can trust, and so you're kind of ranging into darker corners of the internet. And I think, you know, from an epistemology of testimony perspective, there's something really interesting about that. So I've tended to think of that process as not necessarily fundamentally irrational. It's a kind of ordinary process with a kind of epistemic bad luck going on.
Interesting. They seem to be rolling and getting snake eyes every once in a while to take them down this dark corner.
Yeah, because I think, you know, this idea that in general we get most of our knowledge from testimony, and it's this question about who you trust.
Yeah.
You get a certain amount of distrust at the wrong time, and I think there's also this big factor that it's, you know, the internet has changed so much about what you're exposed to and who you're exposed to, and like negotiating that is a very tricky proposition. So
I've been interested from a clinical standpoint in terms of, it seems like maybe anecdotally, the folks, I don't doubt that there are probably a variety of different kinds of folks who follow these conspiracy narratives, but I guess it does seem like once folks who I know who are into certain conspiracies seem to be continuously doing it. It's not like they seem to drop in and drop out, you know, and say, oh, well, that wasn't a thing. It's more like this one, and then, oh, there's the next one. Oh, there's the, or like, have you heard about this? It's almost like they've come to a particular way of thinking that is sort of brief. Is that something that you found too, or is that, I'm not sure if that's incorrect. That's my own sort of like just basic observations about folks.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is that kind of thing definitely does happen. And I think, you know, there's an interesting literature from the psychological perspective about, you know, willingness to believe one conspiracy theory is predictive of willingness to believe others. Not like, you know, it's not a hugely strong correlation, but there definitely is that. So that's but I think for me, one of the interesting things is why that's there. So I think in a lot of the psych literature, it's, you know, there are these models that people are just generally attracted to this sort of thing, or, you know, there's what's called a monological belief system where you're trying to fit everything in. Whereas there's another model where, you know, once you think, and I think when you look at even the front page of the Reddit conspiracy site, they have this list of conspiracies that happened. So one of the things that's kind of odd about all this is, you know, the CIA did do a lot of super sketchy things in the 60s and 70s. Like, there's a whole line that doesn't get talked about as much, but of mostly African-American conspiracies about medical experimentation on blacks. But those are not completely unfounded conspiracy theories. So I think there's this thing where once you realize that some of these happen, and it's almost like you feel like you've got to be vigilant about it, or you've got to look for the other ones because it's not unreasonable to think that there might be other ones. And then, but then of course that, I think that becomes self-reinforcing as well. So I think it's, I guess part of the, one way to put the interesting question is whether you want to give a sort of more psychological, in the sense of kind of character trait explanation, or something about the content itself that encourages further investigation.
Which is further of what you're focusing on specifically terms of understanding.
But it's all, I mean, I should say one of the things I'm interested in the background, actually how I got started in it really in the first place was, and I have to go soon, but I know you wanted to talk about big challenges in philosophy.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to follow up with you, and I know, we'll wrap things up.
So I'll say both of these together, is it's really interesting to work and get my hands dirty with a kind of big data project. So one of the things that's coming, certainly from fMRI, is what you do with enormous data sets and theory testing in enormous data sets. And I think most of our thoughts about theory testing, and certainly theories about theory testing, have come up in this environment where getting evidence at all is very hard, and getting like, you know, getting a little evidence or trying to find a telling thing. But now you can get, you know, if you write to like the WashU Connectome project, they've been doing these amazing high-resolution scans, and if you pay the money for duplication, they'll send you a box full of 16-terabyte hard drives.
Oh.
it takes a very long time to duplicate the volume to log. And so you just have this amazing amount of data to play with, and a lot of the, and in some sense, it's easy to pull out conclusions. It's so easy that you start wondering whether you're getting any robust thing, or you've just got so many points that it's easy to fit something to it. Mm-hmm. So I was joking, you know, as I'm going through doing this conspiracy thing, I'm like looking at these tables of numbers, like, yes, I see the pattern here. And so I think trying to think about those things and trying to think about, you know, what, for example, robustness might look like, or, you know, the role of different algorithms and different sciences, and how, you know, how the fact that now, for example, so we've got a paper, co-author on a paper that just went back out to NeuroImage, but this problem that it was a bunch of single cell recording stuff, that you can throw a bunch of different dimensionality reduction algorithms at them, at this data, and get very pretty pictures with each one. And it's very easy to do this. I mean, the main author, Aaron, made great pictures with it, but you know, but they're never the same picture as the other algorithms. So you're getting like these very nice, interesting views at very complicated data, but you're getting different views depending on which, you know, prima facie equally good algorithm you run.
Sure.
And so there's really interesting stuff there, whether that should make you an anti-realist. There's I hung out with some Tal Yarkoni, amazing guy, runs a great meta-analytic website called Neurosynth for fMRI data, but I finally convinced him that he's just become a kind of von Frassenish constructive empiricist. So,
oh, really?
yeah, like this is what he thinks the conclusion should be. And you know, he's pretty like enthusiastic about that, and I think I can feel the pull of it. So if you want to be a realist about some of this stuff, or you want to, you know, like I think a lot of these questions are the ones that are coming up now, and I think are, you know, have really, you know, are going to be increasingly important as we switch towards this big data regime. So
that's I appreciate you sharing with us. I certainly have seen some of the greater challenges that we face with big data, and especially because it seems like many of the sciences, especially the biological sciences, seem to be going in that direction. So
yeah.
All right.
So.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you, Colin. I sincerely appreciate you taking the time to chat this morning, my evening. Good luck with your meeting with a grad student. And
Thanks a lot, Nick. It was really lovely, and I appreciate you having me on.
Of course. Thank you again. And yeah, if I'm ever in Sydney, I will let you know.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. Take care, Colin. Bye.
Bye.